Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. I am Sonny Bunch, culture editor at The Bulwark. I am pleased to be joined today by Tom Schoen. Tom Schoen is the film critic for the Sunday Times, and he is the author of five books, including Blockbuster, How Hollywood Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Summer, and Martin Scorsese, a retrospective. For the purposes of this show, most importantly, he is the author of the Nolan Variations, the movies, mysteries, and marvels of Christopher Nolan. Mr. Schoen, thank you for being on the show today. Really appreciate it.
I'm pleased to be here. Thanks for asking.
So one way I judge a successful book is if it encourages me to go out and buy another book. And your book has accomplished that feat. I went out and picked up the collected fiction of Jorge Luis Borges after reading, because I was very fascinated to learn that this is one of Nolan's most recommended authors, one of his own, you know, kind of muses. And I want to start by talking a little bit about how interrogating an artist about another artist is always a very interesting and tricky thing. And I'm curious how you went about it in this book and what you learned from his work and his method.
I mean, it's so interesting you should pick up on that. I mean, the fact that he was a big kind of Borges reader was the first thing that I fastened on when I met him in 1999. I just thought it was very unusual taste, you know, for a filmmaker to have. So that was immediately what caught my interest. And when it came to writing the book, he didn't want a biography. So what was it going to be instead? And I sort of thought, well, what if I just take all his kind of influences and inputs and inspirations and so on, and sort of, if you like, kind of write his biography through them, you know, because I know in my own case, and, you know, I'm sure in your own, you know, when you fasten on like a filmmaker or a writer in your sort of teenage formative years, it says a lot about who you are. So it's got a lot to do with your identity. So I just assumed that the same had to be true, you know, like tenfold, you know, for him, you know, as a kind of emerging kind of artist trying to find out who he was. So I figured that the tastes and his kind of canon, if you like, I had this idea that he had a personal canon, and, you know, and that if you could go deeply enough into that, you would just find out, you know, enough about him. So that was the basic idea. So, you know, talking to him about, you know, these, I mean, he was very, the great thing about it is that it's a level playing field, because when you're a fan of somebody, I mean, he spoke as a fan, you know, he spoke as a film goer. Mm-hmm. So that was something that was just very easy for me to kind of relate to. You know, because in that instance, we were kind of equals. So that was the thrill of it. You know, just sort of talking about these films that had had a kind of big influence on him, or books, or whatever it might be. And sort of, you know, being a very approachable way of talking about him anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to reading your book. You know, one of the big themes in Nolan's work is identity. You know, what is it, who are we? What do we, where do we come from? That sort of thing. And one thing you picked up on is his attachment to both Borges and Raymond Chandler. Mm. They're the kind of the synchronicities that you see in their lives with Nolan's. When you're sitting here analyzing his work, you know, how does that kind of play into it? I find it's tricky to, you know, say of a director, he grew up this way, so it obviously influenced this and this, but there is still an element of that.
Yeah, I mean, you've picked up on the other really, I think, like interesting, you know, kind of taste of his, which is Chandler, and the two Borges and Chandler, they're the sort of the two that I really homed in on the most, for precisely that reason, you know, which is that, like, although he wasn't always entirely cognizant of it, there was something in the kind of biographies of both of those writers that mirrored or echoed elements of kind of Nolan's own kind of upbringing and background. And, you know, I guess I was sort of, it was just a case of like seeking out like, you know, like for in the case of Chandler, he did know that there were a lot of kind of similarities. I think, you know, the fact that Chandler had lived in Chicago and then in London and had attended, it wasn't exactly a boarding school, but a kind of a day school of, you know, a similar kind of stature as his. And he did know about that. He was less sort of on top of like Borges's biography, but he, you know, knew the stories obviously and read them millions and millions of times. Mm. And was a little bit more surprised in a way by the echoes that Borges's upbringing, and Borges was kind of moved around a lot as a kid, and he kind of went around the world several times and exiled from, you know, from Argentina, and then finally returned when he was 21. And a lot of that kind of echoed the way that Nolan had sort of moved around the world too. And I don't think he necessarily had made that connection before, but I thought it was kind of interesting that like the two biggest people for him were people who'd shared some of his experiences. So, you know, I kind of worked on the assumption that if I was ever talking about Chandler, I was really talking about Nolan.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. Mm. Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I strongly recommend if people want to kind of get a glimpse into Nolan's, resources, artistic resources, the collected fictions of Borges is fascinating. I haven't had a chance to read the whole thing, but every time I flip to a story, I'm like, oh,
yeah,
I can see this. I mean, one in particular, I was just reading this morning, The Garden of Forking Paths. I was just like, okay, yeah, I can see time as the kind of infinite and wily enemy of our age. It fits in perfectly with his body of work.
It's wild. I mean,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, you know, Borges is one of those kind of influences that was sort of, it was so great on it that it really went beyond like this story on that film, although there are those correspondences, you know, between, you know, the stories and the films. But it really was a case of like a kind of a sort of twin soul. You know, he was so similar to him that the influence kind of overflows any one film or book and is literally almost in all of them. I could say, you know, you could simply say, you start reading his work, you're like, oh, this is incredibly like Nolan, you know. And it was sort of Escher's the other one like that, where I was like, the influence of Escher was just so great that it you know, it's like, which film wasn't influenced by them? It was an easier question to, you know, answer a lot of the time.
This isn't a literary podcast. Let's talk movies here. I'm always interested in the backstory and kind of business of how these things come together. How did you get access to Christopher Nolan? Were there guidelines? Was it just like, okay, he's going to be in New York for a couple of days, let's grab an hour? I mean, how did the series of interviews come about that form the backbone of this film?
Sure.
Or book, sorry.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was basically, I kind of went over to LA and we had like over a period of several years in the end. But we would have like these sessions that would last for about a week or maybe 2 weeks, and we would just have the mornings. And he was, at the time, he was writing Tenet. So, would just sort of write in the afternoons and in the mornings when I didn't sort of meet with him. And we would sort of meet up at like 9 o'clock and go for sort of 3 hours. And then by the end of 3 hours, you know, both were a little bit tired. But it was really just a series of back-to-back, you know, interviews at he has a sort of production facility like in, you know, near where he lives. So it was like, that's where it took place. And, you know, and then after that, you know, it was more a case of like, you know, there were kind of follow-up views. And then I had to wait for he went and made Tenet. And then I sort of met up with them again after that. So that was the last interview, was like in December of 2019, you know, when he was in the editing room on that with that film. So all in all, it was over a kind of, you know, more or less a three-year period. And it felt, you know, it felt pretty endless, you know, but I met him first in 99 because I'd interviewed him for a magazine about Memento, and then we'd, you know, done, as is often the case, if you sort of do sort of entertainment journalism for long enough, you sort of often recur with people, and you're like, I'd interviewed him then again for Interstellar, and then again for Dunkirk, and time I would sort of say, hey, you know, what about a book? And each time he would say, you know, I don't think I've made enough movies yet. But then he made too many movies, and his argument like crumbled, and he kind of caved. But, you know, I mean, he's perfectly accessible, you know, in the sense that, you know, he sort of jokes that he's the most accessible kind of reclusive director in America, meaning, you know, although he's very private about his own life, he does interviews, and he's accessible to journalists, and he, you know, whenever a movie comes out, he'll help promote it and so on. So actually reaching him wasn't sort of, you know, too difficult. But yeah, I had to sort of work on him to sort of get him to trust me to do a kind of larger sort of and it helped that I'd sort of done enough. I'd been round the ring, you know, with him enough times collaborating on sort of, you know, journalism pieces, and one in particular where there was just a lot of, you know, collaboration and back and forth. And I think it just sort of meant that he, you know, felt like he could kind of go forward with the book.
Yeah. I'm sure it was tricky talking to him in terms of, you know, what talking about what the movies mean, analyzing them and analysis of it, because, you know, at one point in your book, you mentioned that, you know, part of the appeal of Christopher Nolan, and one of the reasons he has become one of the big brand name filmmakers in the last 20 years, is because there is an uncertainty or an ambiguity to his work, and ambiguity in a good way, not in a, you know, what does this mean? Who can figure it out sort of way. Did it ever get frustrating? Did it ever get, you know, was it ever tricky dancing around the, you know, tell me what this movie means, you know, sort of questions?
Yeah. I mean, I sort of found out pretty quickly that if you kind of ask him point blank, you know, why are you so interested in time, or, you know, any of these things, those questions, I think because he's been asked them so many times, don't necessarily get you very far. And I found that the sort of the head-on approach, you know, with it just didn't sort of work so well. You know, he's resistant, initially at least, resistant to the idea. He's a kind of big formalist. So for him, you know, if left to his own devices, when he describes his movies, he'll sort of describe them as kind of genre pieces where, you know, there's not necessarily some content or theme that he's trying to express or something he's trying to say. He's just creating an effect in the audience. And, you know, that's his, it left to his own devices, that's how he describes it. But then you're like, well, if that's true, how come you keep returning to these themes, you know, like time or identity or whatever it is, again and again and again? So there was a sort of, there was something wrong with that account. You know, I was like, well, there's definitely some element of personal expression here that isn't just simply a genre exercise. And, you know, the question for me was how to kind of coax that out of him, because I think one of the reasons that he's, you know, as successful as he is he's learned how to relate and talk to the studio heads who give him the money to make the movies. And I think he's learned just instinctively that the one word they fear the most is artist. You know, like, that's the one word they don't want to hear when you're watching a $200 million movie. So everything about him is really about sort of making sure that there's nothing scary going on here, folks. There's no element of like me getting obsessed with this theme that simply has to come out of me and I'm just going to get to it however I can. That is distressing noise to like a studio executive. So it comes cloaked in, you know, well, this is what we're going to do to this genre. This is the audience we're going to get with this. And so that's how he talked. But I didn't really buy it in the sense that, like, as I say, these themes were there, and there is an element of obsession there, and there is something driving them that is beyond just a studio kind of filmmaker. I thought, I came to think of it as a bit of a, he had like a shadow, he had like a twin, you know, there was another Nolan somewhere under there. That really was much more kind of, there's an artist, actually, to tell the truth. I was trying to out the artist. He was very resistant to that idea. I mean, obviously it sounds great, you know, and he liked the sound of it, but, you know, but he's trained himself not to think like that. So I had to kind of, you know, try and coax it out of him.
Sure. I mean, it's interesting that you bring up talking to studio heads and getting, you know, essentially giant checks to play about with. And it is... I'm curious, you know, when you were talking to him about the business of filmmaking, as opposed to the artistry of filmmaking, you know, what his take on the whole studio system is, what is, you know, how he is able to do what he does, which is, you know, make giant personal films, which sounds like a contradiction, but that's what he's been doing for 20 years now.
I know, I wish I had a kind of easy answer to that. I mean, it's definitely the thing that's most fascinating. Giant personal films is like a really good way of putting it. I mean, how does he get it past them? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think one thing he said was like, he sort of learned early on that if he learned to tick a certain number of boxes, they would give him the freedom to do what he wanted. So in other words, if he had certain things covered in terms of, let's say, the amount of action there was in a movie, or the amount of kind of the ease with which they would be able to promote it, or whatever it is, if he had those bases covered, that they would leave him up to his own tricks. And so that definitely lodged in my head. The other thing he said was that he's very transparent with them up to the point where he kind of starts shooting. So he's not at all secretive with the what his plans are, you know, what he plans to do, what the script is. And he goes in and he just repeatedly will sort of pitch almost every inch and corner of the film to them. So they know exactly what they're getting. So he's incredibly transparent in that respect. And then once he starts shooting, it's different and off he goes. But by that point, they kind of trust him. I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, he's there's a certain amount of transparency. I think there's a certain amount of kind of maybe also deviousness kind of going on. I think, like, you know, but I think he realizes that, like, they've got other things. They've got other dramas going on in their life, in their business life. He just needs to give them no reason to worry. And they'll kind of leave him alone. And I think ultimately maybe his sort of run of successes has kind of helped him enormously in that. Like, I mean, I think after The Dark Knight, they more or less kind of gave him carte blanche to do what he liked, you know. And I mean, they didn't say that in so many words, but he understood that that was the case. I think maybe the trick now for him is sort of like how he recreates that, the opposition, you know, like, because when you're a young filmmaker and you're trying to persuade someone, you're going against the grain, you're fighting to win them over. And then the moment they then become yours and they start saying yes rather than no, the question then becomes, how do you recreate that? Because it gives you great discipline to have to fight and to persuade, and it enforces its own kind of discipline on the film. So what do you start doing when people start saying yes more or less all the time? And that's where he kind of relies very much on, like, you know, Emma Thomas, his wife, and Jonah's brother, and his kind of collaborators, if you like, to kind of keep him in check. But he definitely, like, works well. I mean, he's just got that really weird, I just the word double jointed kept on coming up for me. I was like, he's got this really strange and miraculous double jointed ability to, you know, please two sets of masters. On the one hand, the studio heads, and there's no harsher set of taskmasters, but then also his kind of muse, you know, at the same time. And it's a really strange sort of skill set, you know, but he has,
yeah.
You know, it's kind of the thing that, like, those, you know, the critics, you know, who came up with auteur theory in the 60s, the French, you know, film directors who were also film critics and writing about auteur theory, that was the quality they kept, they themselves found most miraculous about the Americans, you know, all the movies that they were now watching. They were like, God, it's so incredible that they're in the middle of the heart of the machine, and yet they're kind of making these films that, like, have this kind of thumbprint or voice or, you know, vision. And it's definitely true of him.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just such a weirdly ineffable quality. And there's obviously something to him, you know, specifically. One thing that I picked up on, you mentioned it once or twice in the book, is his color blindness. He is green color blind.
Yeah.
And how, you know, how that kind of conflicts with his sense of the, you know, the subjective versus the objective reality, right? The sense in everybody's mind that they see the world in a way, and that's the way it is. But that is obviously not the case in certain regards. And I'm wondering, you know, how you think that has played into his kind of artistry and the sorts of films that he has made over these years.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, he worked out that he was colorblind relatively young, I think, maybe, like, you know, I never got the exact age, but it was sort of like a middle childhood, some 7 or 8 or something. And I'm not sure whether it was at school or not, but he sort of often, he noticed that, like, people's first reaction whenever he told them that they was colorblind is like, oh, look at this, that they would confront him with the very color he just told him he could see, which is like green in his case. And they would say, so what do you see? So do you see that? Do you see that or not? Like, what's good? Like, it made him feel like a freak, you know, like, and it's a small thing, but like he nevertheless noticed that, like, when you kind of fessed up to, like, something like that, people's first instinct is perhaps sometimes a little cruel. And he said that factored into Memento when he was writing Memento. You know, one of the big differences between his draft of that script and Jonah's initial treatment is that, like, when Christopher Nolan wrote it, he realized just how amazingly vulnerable Leonard's condition would make him. You know, the fact that he could not remember anything beyond, you know, however many minutes ago, that hadn't been in Jonah's treatment. But Christopher he immediately sensed, oh wow, people would really take advantage of that really fast. And so you really get then the more or less the plot Memento blooming from that very idea, you know. So I'm not sure that it had like a kind of big impact, but it certainly had like an input into Memento, the screenplay of it.
Sure.
But yeah, he's definitely got a very skeptical cast of mind, you know, the sort of fear that we might be kind of trapped inside our own perceptions and heads, you know, drives a lot of those films. It's a curious, it's many of his protagonists, not just Leonard, are kind of, you know, trapped in the prison of their own perceptions on things, and it's proven subsequently, you know, to be wrong. I'm going to guess that it's a kind of pretty big fear of someone who's very bright like he is. You know, you can kind of almost convince yourself of anything. You know, smart people can be a little bit dumb sometimes, you know, and so the idea that, like, your head might not be entirely trustworthy is a kind of one that I think is very, you know, big with him. I think he said The Shining, which was a pretty terrifying movie for him, for that reason. But yeah, like the sort of the fears of, like, intense subjectivity, because essentially, yeah, you would be, you know, the idea of what it threatens is isolation. You know, it's like you're just cast off. You're not going to be able to connect with people. And I think that is very, I mean, you just look at his movies. I mean, they connect with like communication, connecting with people is a really big deal for him. So the fear is not.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned him wanting to connect with people. And one thing that really comes through in your interviews is a sort of kind of wry sense of humor. There's this great moment when you're talking about Interstellar. And you were kind of questioning him about something, and you're like, look, I like it. And he replies, like it more unreservedly, which like I could see reading that and thinking, oh, what an ass, like, you know, this is very, but the way it comes across to me, at least, is kind of winking and playful. First off, am I misreading that? Or was that a command to actually like it more unreservedly?
But the thing is that I don't want to. Your basic point is right, that he has like a very wry and playful sense of humor. In that moment, you know, maybe just because we were disagreeing about something, I was perhaps not picking up so much on the humor at that point. That could have been me, though. And things read different; they come across differently when you tell the story, as it were. So, but he definitely has, very wry. Kind of sense of humor. I mean, if you sort of say, "I will," you know, my favorite film of yours is Inception. His response is, "So what's the matter with the others?" You know, which is kind of a version of that. Yeah. You know, that definitely is a joke, but it's also not a joke. Like, you know, you also that like a bit of him is like, "Well, you know, what are you trying to say?" Like, there's that kind of, you know, and you sense some artistic ego there, you know, like he likes to think that he doesn't like to think of their flaws very much. And he was very reluctant, actually. I mean, nobody is really, are they? Nobody wants to talk about the flaws of something they've produced. And I wasn't really convinced that there were sort of major, you know, major things wrong with Interstellar, I had a bit of a battle on my hands, but you know, he actually wanted that. Like, there was a version of that chapter where I was kind of being a little mealy mouthed about something, and I was trying to hint maybe or insinuate that I wasn't, I had difficulties with some elements of the plot. Mm-hmm. And he sort of said, look, I think you really ought to just spell this. I think you need to come at me a little bit more. Like, we did another interview, in fact. And he sort of said, he just said, I can take it. Like, it's not going to hurt, you know? So in that mm-hmm. sense, he was kind of encouraging and, you know, of criticism. And, you know, there was certainly no, and I'll definitely say this for him, like, there was no attempt to tamp down, you know, any kind of critique I might give of something, you know. As I say, on the contrary, he almost sort of wanted it to be more combustible. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, that says good things, you know, for him. He was a good collaborator. I mean, you always think, oh, they're, you know, all film directors are going to be control freaks, and to some extent they are, but, you know, they're also very good at kind of collaborating with other people, and, you know, and it being a kind of playing well with others, you know. And he was good at that, and, you know, it surprised me, although it shouldn't have done.
Well, the reason I brought this up is I'm curious if there's any, you know, if there's any resentment or frustration on his part that so many critics push back on his work as being cold or, you know, mechanical or distant. I mean, this was part of the discussion in Interstellar, is that, you know, people were picking at plot holes, nitpicking a little more than some of his other movies. And I can understand him being frustrated at that after having, you know, the last 10 years, 15 years, people say, well, he's such a cold clocksmith
right.
that, you know, how, you know, what's the matter with this?
Yeah. I mean, he's very, what's the word? I mean, he gives the impression, I think, that nothing that people say or the kind of criticism really gets to him. Like, he's quite sort of diffident when he talks about it. Nonetheless, I think that being sort of, I think being kind of hearing what people make of the films is a disconcerting one. And I think that the cold thing in particular, I mean, the one stroke of luck I had when writing the book is I didn't necessarily think it was true. Like I there's definitely emotion in the films, and I knew even before Interstellar, which has obviously got a wrenching kind of emotional sort of tone to it, that Memento is just of, I think that kind of when people sort of describe a filmmaker as cold, I'm not sure they're kind of really describing very well something. I mean, a movie that you had no emotional reaction to at all would be another experience altogether. Like, if you simply don't engage on any level emotionally with a movie, the first feeling you're going to have is actually boredom. Like, that's, so when people talk about his movies being cold, I don't think they're really using the right word. I mean, unless they are also bored, but I don't think they are. They're talking about something else. I think what they're talking about is that the emotions are often sort of very, they might be deep down below, they might be held in check, or that they might be held in back, or they might be restrained in some way, which I guess is a very kind of English thing. But being English too, and I definitely, I could kind of identify the still waters run deep syndrome, like they're definitely there. And sometimes all the more powerful for not really being kind of expressed sort of directly. Or that's a long answer to the question of how he responds to criticism. I mean, I think, he's been around enough, and I think he's sort of, tough skinned enough not to sort of care. But I think, I think it's more puzzling actually as anything else. I think it's just a little mystifying, because he can see the emotion in Dunkirk. He can feel it. And I think he's right to be puzzled. I think it's not really the word people are looking for.
I will say that I experience his films different. A little bit differently after Fatherhood. I mean, the Prestige, Inception, and Interstellar all play much differently, frankly, after becoming a parent. And I wonder if that is not, if people just overlook that whole aspect to it, the father and children angle. I don't know.
I mean, there's no question in my mind that that once you get to the Prestige, the maker of that film is married and has felt the tug of like home life and work life, because that's what that film is about. Gordon is sort of like is trying to do both, and the film is about this kind of collision of those two things. So there's no question that even a film as kind of on the surface as sort of tricksy and as kind of puzzle oriented and as plot laden as The Prestige reflects this kind of shift in his own, family life, and then you get to Inception and you think very much like the family that he's kind of created is very much in that film. I mean, it's very direct kind of biographical references to his children and that. I think, the film that really brought that home for him was The Dark Knight, because it was such a long shoot. And so he was away from them for a long time, and he really noticed that he'd missed a chunk of their, childhood, essentially.
Yeah.
Much like we see in Interstellar, And so the conversations that Leonardo DiCaprio has with his kids back home, I think he said that was very... that was lifted from, conversations that he'd had. I mean, not word for word, but just in, the tenor and emotion of them, missing them, wanting to get back home. I think it's maybe easily overlooked. I mean, he was a father many times over by the time he made Inception. And again, I think you can tell, But yeah, like, but you know, even Memento, I think there's definitely a kind of, and then yeah, Memento is kind of like, that's like somebody who is the fear in that, which is the fear that you might be betrayed by, you know, his sort of intimate partner, who's a woman. That's, you know, that you can read that as like coming from a certain station in life, relatively new to long-term kind of emotional commitment, and that's roughly where he was, and you know, so they definitely kind of reflect him.
This is my last written down question. This is the last, but the I was very interested to hear his take on the kind of stateside and elsewhere discussion over the politics of the Dark Knight. And I, you know, as somebody who kind of came up in political journalism, this was a long run. Years of my life spent arguing about this with people. So when he says, this is a quote from your book, quote, "I feel very good about what we did in the Dark Knight trilogy because it has been equally claimed by the right and by the left in terms of conversation." And I think I mean, I have my own POV on this. It's neither here nor there, but I really like his acceptance of the ambiguity and his acceptance of the ability for people to disagree about what it means, rather than stridently kind of saying it has to be this, because there's no shortage of movies about things that have to be a certain way. And it is pleasing to see somebody thinking about this sort of stuff in, frankly, you know, big budget populist popular entertainments, yeah. Right? Like this is a welcome thing. Is it a thing he really thinks about a lot? I mean, like his work doesn't seem strictly speaking ideological or political on a explicit level, but that kind of, you know, sentiment undergirds a lot of it.
Yeah. Listen, I think you're right that the strength of that film is the kind of ambivalence it has towards kind of, you know, order, chaos, structure, chaos. Like he's caught between them, and there's great ambivalence in that film and great ambivalence in him. It always makes me think of like the archetypal film for this is Apocalypse Now, and it always makes me think, you know, Francis Ford Coppola went into that film thinking, I'm going to make the greatest anti-war movie ever, but the script he got from John Milius loved the Vietnam War, right? You know, he was the kind of, you know, the smell of napalm in the morning guy. And he wrote this in the middle, this kind of incredibly kind of pro-war, gung-ho sort of movie. But between them, they create something great, because it's both a pro-war movie and an anti-war movie at the same time. And I always think of Apocalypse Now as being like the kind of benchmark of that kind of, you know, two things at once. But Nolan is he's totally like that. I mean, you know, he's definitely like, there's elements of kind of small C conservative, but then there's also, you know, he's socially liberal and Democrat leaning, and, you know, like it gets, you know, the British thing is, it factors in again a little bit. It's because the British political system is not quite as far right, I would say, as kind of the American one. I totally realize that might be up for debate, and you know, but I think, you know, my own hunch is that like in England he might be more conservative, but that it moved to America, you know, yes, you end up being, you know, leaning Democrat. So there's a blend of things going on in his own views. But very much, definitely, the film really benefits from, like, you know, because, yeah, there's such a, you know, I don't know what your view on it is, but, like, I remember when I saw it, I was thinking, wow, this is kind of incredible. Here's this movie that seems to be alluding to, like, some of the darker shenanigans of kind of the Bush years. And, like, it seemed very much like an allegory of, like, some of the sort of ruthlessness of someone like Cheney, or, you know, and the kind of sort of under the desk sort of dark work that needed to be done in democracy's name. You know, while the people out front needed to believe in sort of Harvey Dent, keep their illusions intact, you know, but the real sort of bruising work is going on. To me, that's how I, you know, kind of read, that's how I read it.
Yeah.
You know, but
yeah, equally, I've written this before, but I mean, it is essentially, it takes every argument during the post 9/11 era about surveillance, about, you know, enhanced interrogation techniques, even extraordinary rendition. I mean, even, you know, heading off to China to grab the financier. I mean, it's a really interesting melange of ideas. And yeah. The thing I most appreciate is him not saying like, okay, it has to be done this way or not done this way.
Sure. Well, I think he kind of always, you know, I mean, it really comes down to, I think, the kind of conception of, you know, Batman that he had. I mean, the thing that was kind of, I thought, you know, the thing that was so interesting and original about the first film was that Batman essentially learns his skills from the enemy, you know, and his apprenticeship is at the knee of his enemy. And I was like, that's a very unusual backstory. I mean, obviously it's something that he came up with. You know, but there was no comparable, maybe you can correct me, but I couldn't think of any comparable superhero backstory where essentially, you know, Superman doesn't kind of learn Lex Luthor's knee. And maybe there is an example, but I couldn't off the top of my head think of that, like where, but he was very interested in having kind of Bruce Wayne go off and, if you like, learn the dark arts, you know, which I thought was, so the ambivalence is right there from the very beginning, you know, and I think that kind of kept some of his, if you like, more liberal side in check, because he was always aware that there was this rather Faustian story that he told about, you know, somebody who went off and learned, sort of, if you like, kind of learned how to be a thug, you know, and overseas, and made a kind of pact with the devil almost, and kind of came back and wasn't sure how he felt about that pact that he made. You know, that to me, yeah, I mean, I think that it goes right to the heart of just how he conceived of that character, you know. So, yeah, it's to me, that's what was interesting about that character anyway, just how ambivalent it was, how kind of, you know.
And it's, you don't see this sort of thing in, certainly in comic book movies a great deal, which is, or at least you didn't at the time. I mean, I don't think I'm, you know, blowing anybody's mind here by saying that The Dark Knight really changed, you know, how heroes in this sort of movie can be treated and depicted.
Yeah, definitely. Although the weird thing is, I think just an interesting kind of footnote is when you press him on, like, you know, the question of the pessimism versus the optimism of his sort of take on things. And he expresses some surprise at, like, people seeing The Dark Knight as dark as it, that, you know, it was the movie that kind of darkened kind of comic book adaptations, but it doesn't really necessarily see it that way. It's kind of interesting. I think because he was very conscious of, at the time, trying to thread this needle of sort of making sure that it was still going to work for the intended audience. You know, I don't think he gave too much. I think a lot of that stuff just came out in the wash simply because of who he is, you know. You know, he was always trying to make sure that it didn't, at least the first one. I think the second one is a lot darker. I mean, I get the impression from talking to him that there was something kind of in The Dark Knight, the movie The Dark Knight, that he kind of loosed something in that film, in the Joker, that, like, he was a little uncomfortable with. And that was kind of cool. Like, I was like, wow, yeah. It didn't occur to me that, like, that would be the case. But he found Heath Ledger and directing that performance really to be a very uncomfortable, personally uncomfortable thing. And I was like, but how can it be? I mean, aren't you? I was assumed that he was good, that his response, I was like, but isn't it just enormous fun to kind of like let a character like that loose? Like the freedom of him walking in and letting off those kind of, you know, it's like, I felt there was such exuberance, you know, in the performance and such freedom that like he had to be getting off on that in some way. And he said, no, scared the life out of me.
Yeah.
You know, like, and I was like, okay, all right. I believe you now.
Yeah. I mean, a testament to Heath Ledger, who, you know, did something with that character that I don't think anyone was expecting.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. And I didn't, you know, obviously I'd never met Heath Ledger when he was alive, but a very kind of gentle man by all accounts. And, and he was often kind of coming back to Chris and sort of saying, you know, is this okay? I mean, like, he just felt almost like apologizing, I think, for some of the things he was having to do. And he was sort of helping him get to that other place. But it was as uncomfortable for Nolan. It was so weird. Yeah. I literally didn't believe him when he told me that. I was like, oh, he's just telling me. But he really was. Yeah. The Joker terrified him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's... I could go on all day about The Dark Knight. I'm not going to, though. We're gonna move on. There was a photo today. We're taping this on Tuesday. A photo this morning hit the wires. Christopher Nolan back in movie theaters. He was seen in an AMC auditorium in Burbank, taking in, I believe, Judas and the Black Messiah. Obviously, this is a big thing for him. This has been a big cause for him keeping the theatrical experience alive. One of the things I greatly love about him and admire about him and his work is his efforts in this arena. And I am curious if you have any insight into his reaction to the whole Tenet, release fiasco, for lack of a better word. I mean, I got to see it in an IMAX because I live in Dallas, Texas. So I actually got to go see it in theaters. I was very happy, very, very pleased. But I know a lot of people, frankly, just weren't able to. My friends who live in Washington, D.C. weren't able to. Mm-hmm. My friends who live in New York City had to travel, you know, out to Connecticut or New Jersey or wherever to go see it. Mm-hmm. Folks in California. I'm just curious if there's any insight you can provide into, you know, kind of where how he feels about how all of that shook out, how it all went down.
Yeah. I mean, I should say before I attempt to answer that like, you know, because I left him in the editing room in December of 2019 and then went off to sort of put the finishing touches to the book, I never kind of conducted an interview where I sort of talked about that kind of incredibly arduous post-production he had. And of course, the arrival of coronavirus and the whatnot. But we did, you know, when publicizing the book, have enough time to sort of talk here and there about it. And, you know, my general sense was he was distraught by one thing, which was that he thought that the film industry was taking the wrong lesson from it. There was this sort of sense that the coronavirus was accelerating all these pre-existing trends. So for instance, the sort of move towards streamers, and away from theatrical releases. And I think it sort of pained him that the some of the changes that were being affected to kind of cope with COVID were going to turn out to be, if not irreversible, then just giving away precious ground, you know. So I honestly think that, like, he, you know, had just even more extra reason just to think of, you know, COVID-19 as just being his nemesis almost. I mean, it was not only a dangerous, deadly disease, but like something that was also taking away something very precious to him, which is that kind of theatrical kind of window that sort of movies have. And it was eroding it in his view. And so I think that's kind of why you saw him come out so strongly when they, you know, said they were going to move, you know, Dune, you know, and release that.
Right.
Are they still going to do that?
My understanding is Warner Brothers is still releasing everything on HBO Max and in theaters simultaneously through the end of the year.
I mean, I always hoped that they would sort of enough time by the time they got to it, that, you know, there'd be enough theaters open for them to reverse that decision. But anyway, but yeah, so I think that's one I think the only time I can ever think of actually where I saw him not only speaking angrily in public, but speaking angrily in public about, you know, Warner Brothers and or more particularly the people who own Warner Brothers. And so, you know, it definitely, you know, hit a kind of pressure point and touched on, you know, as you said, it's a very important issue to him. I think, and of course, you know, it screwed up the release of Tenet. Like, there can be no doubt about it, at least in this country. Had a luckier time in the UK because it just happened to coincide with this kind of the theatres opening, and there was like a period of just a few months where it just cleaned up and it was a sort of runaway hit. And there are other countries around the world where it kind of did kind of great, kind of typical Nolan business, but it definitely got like taken out the knees here. You know, that's definitely that's gonna hurt.
Yeah, it's too bad. It was great on IMAX. If you can still find it somewhere, folks, go watch it now that the theaters are reopening. Hopefully it'll get a re-release here in the next few weeks. Well, that was everything I wanted to ask you. I always like to ask my guests at the end of the show if there's anything I should have asked, if there's anything you would like to talk about related to your book or otherwise. I leave the floor open to you.
Okay.
To close things.
I think I'll just sort of end on that I was just really surprised, you know, at how well he kind of collaborated on the book with me. I wasn't necessarily expecting it. You know, we had our kind of back and forths, you know, for sure. I found out that when you get notes back from Christopher Nolan on something you've written, the swearing doesn't start until page 100. Up until that point, it's just kind of like, well, you might consider this and, you know, what about that? But after page 100, it's like, this is ridiculous, you know, or whatever, like the margin. And you're like, oh, okay. So we definitely had that process went on. But at the same time, I was really impressed by the fact that he was able to kind of remove himself as the subject of the book and give me advice that sounded a little bit more like the kind of thing you'd expect an editor to say, almost as if he was not the subject of the book at all. I remember there was one note where he was just like, you really found your voice in this chapter or whatever. That's the kind of note that you just, you know, it meant a lot, because it meant I could sort of like isolate what was good about that chapter and kind of then try and repeat it. It was the Inception chapter. And, But again, it was just kind of like, wow, he's almost talking like he's not the subject of this book. It was kind of like, cool. Yeah. It was like, so I got a sense of, you know, the fact of him being able to sort of step outside of his skin to some degree, and that he had this kind of objectivity. And so that made it great because he just continued to sort of work with me. And I think it really benefited from that. It really did. There's no question. That was the big surprise for me, was how great a collaborator he was. And, you know, there was a sort of, you hit on it earlier on, there was a kind of playfulness to him that came out in some of our kind of conversations. And it comes out, you know, I think in the book, but like there, and it's there in Inception. I mean, it's a very playful film. And so that was the side of him that I kind of sort of fondest of and will sort of take away with me was you know just how well he kind of played with others.
There if for people who have not yet read the book, and you should there'll be a link to it in the email, show notes, whatever. But there's this very funny kind of, you have this running almost competitive riddle with him in the book. I won't spoil it for anyone here. You got to read it. But it's very entertaining and kind of, again, gives you kind of an insight into his mind and his method. And your own. Thank you very much for being on the show, Tom Schoen. The book, again, is The Nolan Variations, the Movies, Mysteries, and Marvels of Christopher Nolan. You can get it at Amazon and wherever books are sold. Very, very highly recommended. I will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. See you guys then.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.